So today we're going to talk about sexuality and family within Rav Lichtenstein's thought. I was actually just talking to Rabbi Wiederblank before, and he said that, among other things, this article is significant because it was one of the first times when, you know, someone who was a Rosh Yeshiva, a Torah educator, could really just very head-on discuss all the details of these issues, even though they're sometimes generally seen as more private. So if for no other reason, the article made a difference by discussing it, and his sense was that since then it's become much more commonplace. It was published first in 2005, but it was originally at Orthodox Forum a few years before that, but not that long ago. Right? We're talking about the 21st century when the paper about marriage, relationship, and relations, it's really about sexuality more than about marriage, which, not in the title, but it's still discussing that. Was still somewhat of a novelty. So we're going to look at that piece, talk a little bit about some things that happened in YU in 1966 that tie into that, interestingly enough, and then talk about two related but secondary issues based on talks of Rav Lichtenstein on raising children and homosexuality. So ambitious goals. So the piece on relationship and relations, Rav Lichtenstein opens up by saying he's not sure that he really should be discussing this, which of course fits with the idea that it was somewhat novel, and he talks about his measure of ambivalence and trepidation. First of all, the Gemara says that one shouldn't really discuss sexuality in public, and I guess publication would be included in that. But then the bigger issue, interestingly enough, is that this paper is going to raise issues involving periodization and continuity. Yeah, so those are the two reasons why he was nervous, so to speak, before talking about this, but he still jumped right in. And we'll see over the course of the article, he'll discuss that more explicitly. But he says at the beginning that this isn't pure halacha so much. These are more hashkafic issues of how one should view marriage, how let's say a husband should view a wife. And it's less about specific halachos of what's mutter and what's usur, and more about a general worldview, which in a sense lowers the stakes a little bit, right? It's not the same. Seeing shifts over time is a little easier to stomach if it's hashkafa rather than halacha. And so then he says, let's discuss this issue. He starts with the Rav. Actually in Family Redeemed, which had recently been published at the time. And the Rav writes that there's two basic theories about the institution of marriage, one of which sees the meaning and value of marriage outside of the marriage itself. There's some external factor that justifies that gives value to marriage, and the other view that sees inherent value coming from marriage itself. And he says, seen from the halakhic viewpoint, matrimonial community is not realized without embracing three personae. There are really three different personalities, individuals, as it were, that are involved in a marriage: the husband, the wife, and God. And that's an important way of viewing marriage, as the Rav says, as inherently significant. There's some inherent value to marriage, and part of it is the fact that God is involved. It's part of a divine covenantal relationship as well. So that's an important piece to start with, that Rav Lichtenstein starts with, that marriage is not just about justifying other things, or about not just justified on the basis of other things. And he gives an example of that. He talks about Puruvu, the mitzvah to procreate, the first mitzvah counted in the Torah. So generally, it's assumed that can only only be best fulfilled through marriage. But that's not to say that the entire justification of marriage is just because of Puruvu. That would be an external justification. So even though there is value to Puruvu, to procreation, the way one would value marriage is based not just on that, but on other factors that are more internal to the marriage itself. And with this, Rav Lichtenstein cites the pasuk in Kohelet, Ecclesiastes: "Enjoy life with a woman you love," right? Which shows that there's a value in marriage itself and in marital bliss. He quotes a Gemara that's cited in the Rambam: "Whoever loves his wife as himself and honors her more than himself, then about that the verses said, 'Your tent shall be in peace. You'll visit your habitation. You won't sin.'" All sorts of wonderful quality of life and quality of spiritual life from marriage. So the value of marriage is not just instrumentally important for Puruvu or for other factors or for avoiding sin or something like that, but there's a real value in the marital relationship itself and in in living a life in that structure. But then you get to the question of sexuality per se. And while it's clear that Judaism doesn't really support what he calls unbridled lust, right? The question is how do you see sexual activity within Judaism? And obviously we're not talking about places where it's prohibited, right? Where it's prohibited, it's clear, but where it's permitted within a marriage. Is sexuality a good thing, or is it sort of a necessary evil? You could call this like a sex positive or sex negative perspective, although again, this is specifically within the context of marriage and what's permitted halachically. And here there's going to be a fairly wide range of views. People who see it as very much a good thing and very much something that maybe you have to do once in a while, but that should be avoided. And there's Gemaras that talk about how the marital bed, when a husband and wife get along, the bed is so wide, is so comfortable, and when it's not, no matter how big your physical bed is, you're sort of uncomfortable in that relationship. That seems to say that marriage and even sexuality is something that should be done properly and that should be valued in itself. Or the Gemara talks about sexual activity as one of three things that are me'ein olam haba, a taste of the world to come. The Gemara supports, or the Medrash supports women wearing ornaments in order to increase the love between husband and wife, not avoiding it, but sort of embracing that. The whole idea of nida, the Gemara Nida says, the whole idea of nida, of a husband and wife separating, is to endear them to one another when they return. So, and the idea that marital relations are part of Sabbath delight, are part of the oneg of Shabbos. So all these different Gemaras seem to strongly imply that sexuality itself is a good thing, and that should be embraced. The problem is, if you look at the Rishonim, right, as Rav Volkstein puts it, you look at the Rishonim, you see a different picture. This harvest, or the survey of Chazal, stands in marked contrast to positions adopted by some of the foremost Rishonim, and go straight to probably the two, if not the most important Rishonim, the Rambam and the Ramban. The Rambam has no place for either love or companionship within the idea of marital sexuality. So read the quote here at the top of page 3 in the handout. So too, when one has sexual relations, he should act in order to maintain his health and to reproduce. Right, that's it. Therefore, he should not have relations anytime he desires, only during the time when he must produce semen as a medical need or for the sake of reproduction. Really minimizing sexuality within marriage for when it's absolutely medically or reproductively necessary. The Ramban goes in a similar direction. He says, why is there a prohibition of nida? It's because really the Torah only allows sexual activity for reproduction. So we've minimized it as much as possible when it's not relevant. And during the time that a woman is in nida, she can't reproduce. So there's no reason to have sexual relations at that point. So that's the Rambam and the Ramban. There are other Rishonim that take that perspective. Rav Lichtenstein mentions that there are some Rishonim who have somewhat more of a moderate position, and maybe even a somewhat positive position. The Ravid Balei HaNefesh and the Gerek HaKodesh that's anonymously published. But even there, they're not that strong in their embrace of sexuality, and this is really a minority position, especially compared to the Rambam and Ramban and all the others who take this position. And it really seems like there's a difference, there's a discrepancy between these attitudes of Chazal on the one hand, that's very sex positive, and within marriage, and the Rishonim, which for the most part are fairly sex negative, see it as a necessary thing, maybe for procreation, but not as part of marriage itself, not as valuable to the marriage itself. And Rav Lichtenstein says it's also going to be helpful to take another angle, not just look at it from these general statements, but to look at it through the prism of the mitzvah of onah, of husband's obligation to have relations with his wife on somewhat of a regular basis. There's different positions on how frequent this is supposed to be, but I guess the most striking source of this Gemara in Ketubot, Samach Bet Amud Aleph 62a, where tayalin, which maybe means travelers or something, it's not exactly clear, are supposed to have relations with their wife every day. And the discussion, Rava says, B'nai Pirkei, which sounds like yeshiva students, kolel students. And there's somewhat of a dispute about the details of it, but it sounds like there's a general agreement that at least that there's no opposition to the idea in itself that let's say a kollel couple would be expected to have relations, or a kollel husband would be expected to have relations every day. And to just the Rav Lichtenstein summary of that, the passage expresses neither revulsion from the carnal, fleshly, nor ideological recoil from the manifest blend of the physical, the psychic, and the spiritual, of which sexual experience is comprised. It sounds very, very okay with that frequency of relations. There's a Yerushalmi that says, you know, maybe even assuming that this was the reality in some places, that there was a tevila, wanted to be told themselves after relations in order that, you know, you couldn't just, you know, a man couldn't just sleep with his wife, have learned Torah, have lunch, sleep with his wife again, have dinner, and that's what it sounds like, that would be some sort of, that, you know, if not for this tevila, that would be this ritual immersion, that would be the way things work. So really the source is both prescriptive and even descriptive sources sound like that this was a much, much more frequent thing, and there's no problem with that. There's no, right, if you ask the Ramban or the Rambam, presumably you would think that they would say, why are you having relations so frequently? That's not what sexuality is about. But the Gemara seems very open to that idea. So there's a quandary here. The quandary is, first of all, to quote Rav Lichtenstein, how and why, toward the top of page 4, how and why did Rambam, Ramban, and some other Rishonim deviate so markedly from Chazal's prevalent attitude? Right, their understanding of the Yetzer, very different approaches of indulging the Yetzer, the sexual desire, or avoiding it. Very different approaches between Chazal and the Rishonim. And he writes, the allure of facile historicistic solutions, right, like saying there's Sufi or scholastic influences, the medievals are influenced by the Christians and Muslims around them, is palpably self-evident, right? There's this allure, there's this easy way out to explain why the evidence is varied like it is. But he says the truth is, you know, the Rishonim lived within a society. There were some influences. Upon critical evaluation of what they encountered, they might incorporate something they see as consonant with tradition. And he says, no one questions Aristotle's impact upon Rambam or Kierkegaard's upon the Rav. So I don't know, maybe some people do question it, but at least if they do, Rav Lichtenstein doesn't consider their position worth thinking about. That's clear. There is some influence when it's properly evaluated, but in our case, he writes, we are seemingly dealing with apparent contravention rather than nuanced accretion. It's not like, oh, this idea is interesting, it actually fits with the Torah Hashkafa, let me include it. It's rather a very different view overall of the nature of sexuality and marriage. So how do we view that? How do we approach that? That's one quandary, and the other quandary is our own quandary, right? And Rav Lichtenstein says we, meaning let's say 20th and 21st century observant Jews, basically accept this idea that there should be love within marriage, and that maybe we don't believe in lust per se, but sexuality is a healthy part of a marriage, and it's not just for reproduction. He quotes the Shla as having a formulation that really sees it as very holy. With respect to copulation, when enacted with holiness and purity, it's most holy, bestirring matters above, the world, right, the olamos elyonim, as it were. A person sanctifies himself in the world below, and he's sanctified greatly from the upper, and he fulfills the mitzvah, you shall be holy, kedoshim tiyu. For every copulation resembles that of Adam and Eve, performed in his form and image, right? You're sort of fulfilling and acting properly within the divine image by having relations. So that's, and that basically, Rav Lichtenstein writes, is the attitude that we have in the 21st century. He quotes the Rav to that effect. He says even, he assumes that it's the same, as far as he can tell, within the Haredi world. So if that's the case, and you compare that with the Rishonim, he asks, are we victims of the zeitgeist, the spirit of the time, swept along by general socio-historical currents? Right? In the modern period, people are much more sex positive than they were in the medieval period. So we just, you know, we ignore the Rishonim and just get swept along with the spirit of the times. That's the challenge he's facing. So two challenges. Number one, how could the Rishonim be so different than the Gemara? Is that just, are they just giving in to their historical circumstances and just throw away the Gemaras? And what about us? Are we just throwing away the Rishonim and we're just so servile to our historical conditions? And he writes, he says, three He gives three answers. Number one, we're siding with Chazal, right? So the question, at least for us, is a bit easier to swallow because we actually have the Gemara on our side. That's, I guess, heavier artillery than the Rishonim on the one hand. Number two, at worst, we may be disregarding the attitudinal counsel of some Rishonim. We are not countermanding their psak, right? Going back to that point he made at the beginning, this is not halacha, this is hashgacha. This is how to view this area of life. It's not quite the same as disagreeing with halacha. That weakens the challenge. And then third, and I think most of all, reliance upon our own mentors. That we have gedolim. We have people like the Rav, people in the Haredi world have gedolim as well, who we can rely on. And you know, this actually ties into what we saw last time about the role of gedolim. Right? Gedolim can not only just in the channel of the halacha as it's been, but they can be creative and they can find new directions if they're gedolim sufficiently to find new directions, to find kulas as he wrote about, or in this case to take a different approach hashgafically than the Rishonim, especially if you have Gemara to base it on, if you have something to base it on. Following the gedolim is another justification of the approach here. And yet still, and Rav Lichtenstein always was very intellectually honest with these sorts of things, he says at the end he's left with a lacuna, with a gap. Something still feels missing. The fact that the trajectory of Chazal to Rishonim to us doesn't quite fit the easiest way we would want it to. But he says, we don't really have another choice. Towards the bottom of page 5, he writes, we have to remain true to our abiding spiritual intuitions. If our feeling is that marriages are an important part of marriage is having that sexual component, not just for procreation. So we can't give up on such so fundamental an aspect of physical and psychic reality. We can't say that sexuality, which is such a core part of what it means to be human, for in one way or another, we can't say it's all just a big trap. Right? That can't possibly be. But we can't abandon the conviction that so central a component of human nature is not part of the tov me'od of primordial creation. That God created a world that has sexuality as an important part of it, and that's all evil, right? That Rav Lichtenstein is unable to accept, and instead we're challenged to sanctify sexuality within total sacral existence, and fit it into a world and make it holy. The idea of world redemption, which we've seen previously, he also talks about it in this article. I don't think I cited it. World redemption, we don't deny the world. We don't accept the world fully. We have to redeem the world, take the physical aspects of the world and elevate them, make them spiritually valuable. In this last point, the conclusion, I think we see an important theme that we've seen over and over again, the idea of a holistic integrity of the way of viewing the world. Right? How could it be that God created a world with core fundamental components of human nature that are all just traps? That can't be. The world is all part of God's creation. It's all integrated in that way. So that's the approach here. And he comes out, he sort of starts and ends with a view that believes in romantic love, that believes in sexuality, not just for procreation, but as part of a marriage, as part of living a holy, redeemed life. And along the way, there were a lot of important points about how to square the evidence, how to square the fact that the Rishonim are opposed to this view, although the Gemara itself seems pretty supportive. This whole discussion is very interesting in light of I guess, a situation or something that took place in 1966 in YU. In 66, I think we may have mentioned this when we did Rav Lichtenstein's biography, there were a few people who were sort of Torah Umada expositors here, teaching both in the college and in the yeshiva. One of them was Rav Lichtenstein, obviously. Another one was Yitz Greenberg at the time. And he decided to give a commentator interview where, among other things, he talked about, it's called Dr. Greenberg Discusses Orthodoxy, YU, Vietnam, and Sex. So the last part is the relevant part for us. But among other things, he sort of attacked YU. He attacked modern orthodoxy and Torah Mada, and it's too limited. He needs to think broadly. One of the things he said is we need to take a sex positive attitude. So far, sounds like Rav Lichtenstein. Except what pretty much became clear that he meant, especially when he denied it and later admitted that denial was sort of just to cover himself. What he was talking about outside of marriage. He was trying to find a way. Remember, this was the '60s. find a way to allow for sexual activity outside of marriage and to see that as holy and a positive thing. And at the time, Rav Lichtenstein wrote a response letter, I think entitled Dear Yitzchak, where he took him to task for this view and said, you know, maybe I'll give you the benefit of the doubt that you meant within marriage. But if you meant we need to see the value in sexuality within marriage, well, that's clear. That's clearly our view. I guess it's not as clear if you look at the Rishonim, but at least that shouldn't be too surprising that that's seen as a good thing. And if you're talking about outside of marriage, that's obviously something we reject. We're fully committed to halacha, and you know, even if you have a certain attitude to something, if it breaks halacha, that's not going to be a good thing. And precisely the attitude that views sexuality as positive is one that sees it as positive within a marital relationship. And that this was sort of a blow up. I think one of the reasons why Yitz Greenberg, not too long after, ended up leaving YU and sort of moving, shifting in certain ways outside of the mainstream modern Orthodox community. So that provides an interesting backdrop, maybe almost 40 years prior to Rav Lichtenstein's writing on sexuality. We saw in the article on sexuality that Peruvu is an important mitzvah, although it's not the reason to be married, or not the only reason, or not even the core reason to be married per se. There are other reasons for that, but certainly Peruvu is a very important mitzvah, and not just having children, but raising children, and that's the title of this article. Rav Lichtenstein says raising children is one of the most important things in a person's life. Unfortunately, this is not obvious to everyone. So there's a need to say this, because there are some people, and he'll refer to them later in the article, people who think that there are more important things, learning Torah, let's say, or teaching Torah, and the children will raise themselves. So there's a mitzvah of chinuch, which applies to two things. Number one, chinuch in mitzvos, teaching your child how to fulfill the various mitzvos before they grow up and are responsible for them. But then a broader sense, which I think is the core of the discussion here, is the molding of the identity and personality of the child. Raising the child and both with certain strengths or abilities, and also about bringing their personality out and teaching them to have various relationships with people within their family, with others, to Torah. And chinuch involves all these different things, right? Teaching mitzvos, raising them with whatever qualities they can have, and raising them to have relationships, to connect to people and to Torah. And it's somewhat vague, right? It's not exactly clear how to educate. It's a little different than the mitzvah of chinuch for shaking a lulav. For that, you take the lulav, you shake it however you shake it, and that's it. Here, you're trying to educate for sensitivity, which can be variable, right? There's no one right answer about what sensitivities a person should have and what sensitivities they should teach their child to have. And Rav Lichtenstein relates a bit to his own. How he was raised and the tradition he comes from, which is, as he says, I come indirectly from Brisk and from Voloshin. I guess he married in to Brisk, and they had a very high value on raising children in Brisk. Even he says the whole Brisk yeshiva was founded, it was just Reb Chaim and his family, and then the Griz and his family, and then it spread, and now there's hundreds of students there. But it started out primarily as family education and raising children. And it expanded out from that. He quotes the Rav, who said, why do you deserve to get into Olam Haba? And one of the three reasons he said is because he learned with his children, not just to educate them in general, but specifically to learn Torah with them. That's something that was really prized, is prized, by the Brisker tradition. And he mentions also Rav Hutner supported this. There's a Gemara about Yerushua ben Gamla setting up an educational system, which usually people think was a great thing. The Gemara itself says that. But Rav Hutner says, even though it may have been necessary in its time, it's really a sad day. The idea of having education be institutionalized, done by a school rather than parent learning directly with child, that's really not a good thing. We'd be much better off if parents learned with their children. So that's the general attitude that Rav Lichtenstein has on that, a very pro child raising attitude, including learning Torah and really spending time. And there's a price for that. As Rav Lichtenstein writes, but it's a price that you should be very well ready and willing to pay, and thank God every morning for the ability to pay it. Right? It takes time to raise children; it's not simple. I think when his children were growing up, would spend an hour, at least an hour, with each of them every week learning. If you have six kids, it adds up. You know, you only have so many hours at home, and of course that was aside from all the other things he was doing. And you know, you have a lot of responsibilities at your job, whether your job is being a Rosh Yeshiva or not. But he was saying that this, you know, it's really a worthwhile investment of time. And then the question is, how does one educate? Right? There's no textbook on how to raise kids. I mean, there are now self-help books of all sorts, but you know, there's no authoritative answer on how to do it. But what Rav Lichtenstein suggests is that there be a combination of an assertion of authority on one hand and warmth and love on the other hand, right? Because there's really two different things that a parent needs to instill in their child. One is, you know, this is what we stand for. Let's say we stand for following halacha, we stand for serving God, and that's centrally important. The father or the parent needs to radiate and communicate authority. And Rav Lichtenstein puts it very strongly that the parent represents the Ribono Shel Olam in his home. Right? You're the closest thing to representing God in the home if you want your family to be built on religion. That's on the one hand. And on the other hand, you can't be too harsh. As he puts it, you can't swing for the fences. And if you push too hard, it'll often backfire. And maybe if you aim for a double, that's good enough. Looking like the baseball metaphors. Even in his, I think in his doctoral thesis, he had some of those as well. So, and then he talks about Vince Lombardi also. The point is, you don't want your children, because you're pushing them so hard to rebel, to hate the parent, or to reject what the parent stands for, to reject religion. And that's a real risk that you take if you push too hard. And there are people for whom their children actually left observance because of that. And that's something to be wary of, Rav Lichtenstein writes. But really, the goal is an educational endeavor. The goal is to try to train them to be a certain type of person, and to train them to pursue knowledge, to love Torah, to love knowledge generally. And it's really a centrally important part of life. And he mentions a funny story with Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. So he actually mentions all three of his primary teachers in this article. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik originally thought that, you know, he'd sort of, when the kids were in diapers, that was his wife's job, and he would do whatever he was doing, teaching yeshiva, and, you know, they would take care of themselves. But he soon came to see how wrong he was. And there's a little drasha he has with involving when Levi was born, Ata Yilavai Yishi Elai. This time my husband will accompany me, because as long as there's two kids, you can sort of hold one under each arm. But once there's three, then the father has to take part as well. I'm not sure if he meant that literally, but the point was, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik acted on this and believed that parents have to be involved from the beginning, and Rav Lichtenstein cites this as well. But you don't come at it's not like a chore. It shouldn't be a chore. You should do it with love. You should do it with all the excitement of being able to have this opportunity to raise children, and all the wonderful nachas that comes along with it. So that's part of the picture here. And this is the message Rav Lichtenstein gave to his students. Right? You might think, you know, an intellectual center, a place that believes in learning Torah, and that's so central, and also believes in learning secular studies and being integrated into society. You think, okay, you know, how much time do you have for raising children? You're so busy living the life of the mind. Children would fall by the wayside. That was critically not Rav Lichtenstein's position. He believed that raising children is so important. And even, I think we saw this in a previous class, when asked what his most significant accomplishment was, and there were a lot of things he could choose from, what he said was raising six children to be good people and to spread Torah, and that was what he saw as his primary accomplishment. So he really believed it. So much for that piece, which of course is part of the question of sexuality and family. And now a third and final issue. Article entitled Perspective on Homosexuals, which was a talk in 2012. If I'm not mistaken, I was actually at this talk, if not one very similar to this one, part of a question and answer session where someone asked this issue. And I guess just if we should frame things, 2012 was a couple years before the Obergefell decision, and definitely American public view of homosexuality has shifted radically in the past 5.5 years. So I guess it could be that what Rav Lichtenstein said then nowadays it might maybe less than cutting edge, so to speak. But back then, I think he was one of the few people who had this explicit position, certainly someone of his stature. We'll just keep that in mind as we read it. So the question, someone asked the question, there's been some discussion recently concerning what our attitude as Orthodox Jews should be towards homosexuals in our community. Some of the debate revolves around the meaning and significance of the Torah's designation, to'eva, abomination, and how could he relate to these issues, both individual and communal levels. So, it's what's interesting. Rav Lichtenstein takes the question head on, and he says it's a controversial issue and it's really a hot button topic. But what's fascinating is who he takes on, who he really disagrees with strongly in this context. So first he says that 5-6 years ago, things have shifted significantly. It used to be at some point in the past, if someone was gay, they couldn't be in the army, they couldn't run a business. It was sort of outside. It was seen as not a mainstream thing to do within society, and that's obviously changed over time. And he said that the Torah clearly, as was stated, has a pasuk against homosexual activity. But there's two different ways of looking at that. Some people see it as just the Torah says it's prohibited, and that's the prohibition. Other people say that it's based on the idea that homosexuality is a distortion of nature. It's not the way that God created the world, and that's why the pasuk says to avoid it. Also, there's some discussion in the Rishonim and Achronim as to whether the prohibition is a chok or a mishpat, whether it's seen as rational or a non-rational mitzvah. And that whatever perspective you take on that will change your perspective on homosexuality as per whether it's just a violation of a pasuk or whether it's a violation not only of a pasuk but also of natural law or something like that. So that was sort of the theoretical background. But then when talking about to'eva, I think Rav Lichtenstein came out very strong on this issue. He said, some people think that because the Torah calls it a to'eva, therefore we have to oppose it more than we'd oppose any other prohibition in the Torah. And what Rav Lichtenstein says is, well, first thing you have to do is actually figure out where to'eva comes up. Not only in this context, it comes up by those who don't feed the poor properly, or those who have uneven weights and measures, who cheat in business. And he says, having done that, once you find all these cases, find for me a community which responds and relates to homosexuality as if you're doing something terrible, just like it responds to those who are cheating a little bit on weights and measures. Right? There's no society that, groups and parts of society that will come out very strongly against homosexuality. None of them will come out equally strongly against people who, have their weights and measures a little bit off to cheat people out of whatever, 1% every time. And if that's the case, so then it's probably not these people acting on the fact that it says to'eva in opposition, but it's rather they're using it for whatever political purposes, right? There's now a sort of a hot button issue. They want to take a side and they enlist a word that the Torah uses for their purposes, regardless of the fact that's not actually the weight they're giving to it. And he says it's not to say that we don't take the Torah's formulation seriously. We do, but we should make sure that we're following the Torah and not following some political fight, some hot button issue. Right. He says, don't get me wrong, I'm not in favor of homosexuality. Chas v'shalom, I assume he means homosexual activity. It seems from context what he means. But we do need to agree to abide by a greater measure of honesty in dealing with that community than I think at present applies. Meaning, he's basically critiquing parts of the Orthodox community for taking such a negative view, and it's not based on the Torah, it's based on something else. And he's critiquing them in that way. Then he talks about how, I skipped part of this on the sheet, but the Israel Day Parade, there was a period of time where there was a move to exclude, I guess, LGBT groups from the Israel Day Parade. And Ruchli says, let's think about this for a second. Violating Shabbos, that's clearly a much worse violation. And no one is saying that we should stop Sabbath violators from going to the parade. The only thing that's the only group that's trying to be pushed out, that people are trying to push out, is LGBT groups. So think about that for a second. Is the issue here is the issue here that the Torah prohibits it and you're opposed to it, or is the issue that you're trying to push a certain agenda here? And then finally, just the last point he makes is that how should we, the question is, how should we relate to an individual, who's gay? He doesn't distinguish between if they're out or not out. And it's not clear to me that it makes a difference. At least he doesn't say it does. But he says, what response should we have? And he says, there's different views one might take, especially it's a matter of public debate and whatnot. But he says, let's see, find the line. And this ties into issues of whether you let let someone like this join your shul, get an aliyah, allow their child into school. These are all definitely then, I think even now, are issues that people are debating. He says, if you ask me for my own response, he says he doesn't approve of homosexual activity as prohibited in the Torah, but emotionally, the fire that burns in many hearts today are beyond what I think is proper. And the opposition is so strong that that's really improper. One, and that he takes the side that really we should try to embrace the individual and support them rather than attack them. He doesn't lay out his policies. That wasn't the question. That's not his place. But his view is that it shouldn't be, the opposition that exists or that existed in 2012 was much stronger than that justified by the Torah. I think at the time, certainly, this was, from someone of his stature, was really a cutting-edge statement and saying, why are we being more stringent, so to speak, or more worked up about this issue than other ones? And not in any way because, Rav Lichtenstein played down the fact that it's prohibited in the Torah. That obviously was at the end of the day, he's not going to say something that's usher is permitted. But at the same time, the compassion that needs to be in place and the consideration of all the various factors needs to be there, and one shouldn't use the Torah for their political agenda of opposing a certain group.